software-defined radio. When I first heard of software-defined radio, I heard all these comments about how, oh, it's very, going to be very flexible. The user will be able to program in various new modes as they come online, and if somebody comes up with a new transmission mode, you'll be able to write software for it to take care of that new mode. And yet it seems that the commercially available software-defined radios completely lock you out of doing any such thing. And I guess that's one of the things that I find about SDR that really kind of turns me off to it. I mean, I still have my old Japan Radio Company equipment here, and being able to dig into it and change something, as I've done a couple of times, has really been a pleasure. It's almost designed to be repairable. And when I think about SDR, it just seems that they completely lock you out of anything. Go ahead.
AC2GS. So it's sort of a two-edged sword. In theory, a software-defined radio is defined by a software from the name. And so if you can change the software, you change the radio. When I initially bought my 6700, it was only capable of CW, AM, and single sideband. It did not do FM. With a firmware update, it learned how to do FM. It learned how to operate with a repeater, injecting PL tones and offsets and all kinds of fun stuff. And so, you know, the only thing to a degree beyond the specifications of the circuitry is the imagination and the financing of software engineers. The problem with modern-day high-end software-defined radios is that they use somewhat esoteric chipsets. Rather than the CPU that most people are familiar with in Intel-based CPUs or even Apple RISC-based CPUs, a lot of SDRs, my 6700, uses things called field programmable gate arrays. They tend to be rather expensive. They're incredibly flexible. They're kind of like design-your-own-chip, almost. But there's a limited number of people with expertise in knowing how to program for field-programmable gate arrays. So you could not kind of sit there and rewrite the firmware for my 6700. It's also locked down with encryption and such. But Flex Radio, if they paid a bunch of programmers, could have a whole bunch of new features ready some point down the road. The problem is that I guess they felt it wasn't cost-effective because the last time they charged $200 for a firmware update and a lot of people got upset with them, so they said, okay, we're just going to freeze things and just change the color of a couple of fonts every so often to show them that we're still alive, which was a terrible decision. So the functionality is the theoretical functionality of software-defined radios is incredible, but it's not something you can cobble together by yourself. At this point in time, it requires such esoteric understanding of software languages for chipsets that very few people know how to program that you need some kind of industry to do it for you and then charge you for that. So the promise is still there, but it's not a common average. You can't have some guy who just retired from an IT department pick up a handbook on field programmable gate arrays and modify their 6700 these days, unfortunately.
Yeah, but, you know, Roy, I'm sure somewhere in the ham radio community we have people who are, you know, fairly knowledgeable on field programmable gate arrays that, you know, could be working on stuff like this. It just seems that the proprietary nature of SDR has just locked things out. It's just that the promise I've always heard about SDR is that, oh, you can, if somebody wanted to play around with already existing software to, you know, I don't know, maybe redefine the specs or do something with it, just play with it a little bit. I'm sure there are those people knowledgeable in the ham radio community that could do that. They just seem to have locked people out. But I guess that's the nature of you know the whole way things are manufactured.
Right. WB2EAV will see you again.
Okay, Ed, I'll get to you in 1 second. I don't want to completely paint Flex Radio as completely evil empire type of thing. At one point, they put out a module that you could insert into the firmware that would do D-Star. You had to get an AMBI chip for the voice encoder decoder and stick it into the back of the radio, but the rest of the D-Star aspects were in that transmission reception mode module that you could add to the firmware, and they even had a API kit where you could kind of engineer your own mode. And unfortunately, no one took them up on it. It kind of languished for a couple of years, and eventually they decided to maintain those third-party module accesses were costing them more money than they wanted to spend, and they just closed the system down. You know, occasionally you'll get some kind of really obsessive, compulsive guy who can go off there and do amazing things. The previous version of Flex Radio's 5000, 3000 series used open-source software to run a lot of things. And there's one guy out there who's updating it, you know, weekly to this very day. And he's built in more features for the older version of Flex Radios than for the new ones, because the new ones were locked down with encryption and such. So you can't really modify modern-day 6000 or probably the future 8000 series, because there's an encryption key you got to deal with in the firmware that no one knows how to break, at least that I am aware of. So it's a lockdown system because these guys want as much money as they can make. There's Tapper, if you remember the Tucson Amateur Packet Radio Club, that engineered a whole software-defined radio system. Apache Labs sells it to this day. I think Tapper kind of got bored and moved on to other things that interested them. And so, unfortunately, the Apache Labs doesn't really do any kind of innovative thing. So you're kind of stuck there. These things have unfortunately sort of become kind of lame horses over time. When creative guys who brought them into being got bored and moved on to something else esoteric.
I see. Okay, thanks, Roy.
Should I get my take?
Certainly, Ed. I just wanted to put my 2 cents worth and try and make Flex Radio seem a little bit better than I earlier made it. Please, Ed.
Two thoughts. Thought number one, if you want to market ham radio, you have to certify its emissions to the FCC. And it's possible that you cannot release a new change without emissions testing that you still meet the FCC requirements. And that's what they're leery about it. Maybe they had their wrist slapped over that once they went back on their original promises. Another thought is maybe they just found there's a lot of idiots out there who think they're very smart and just mess things up, and they were getting stuck back that has just been completely butchered, and they set it up for this.
Well, I think I would have heard, because back in the good old days, I was very busy in their forums. So if someone bricked a 6000 series, it would have been heard all over the place. In fact, Flex Radio themselves bricked a lot of Flex Radios, their operating system. Every so often, a bad version would be released that it would corrupt the SD card, and that's why I had to peel it apart and replace them a few times. So they're certainly, these are good premises, and might have come into the thinking of the people running things. Again, I think it's just money. I think after people complained about paying $200 to get new features, they decided that it wasn't that important to get new features anymore. And besides, there's their military contracts. I understand Flex Radio has a lot of nice military contracts for NSA and all kinds of places. So I guess there was a lot more profits without as much complaining, and so they've moved on to that. But, you know, it would be nice. Hopefully they've announced the 8000 series that might egg them on to improve the firmware and hopefully include us poor schnooks who bought the 6000 series. So I might benefit from their 8000 series. Time will tell. Okay, I guess we're talked out for today. I thank everyone who participated, and I hope that you'll return next week when we try and do this all over again. But it is 10:16, and certainly time for full WS2N and the SpaceNet report.
Thanks, Roy. AC2GS WS2N for the SpaceNet report for the TechNet. And, yeah, a few new things have occurred recently. One this morning by a company called Blue Origin. They launched the new Shepard suborbital spacecraft from Van Horn, Texas, West Texas, with six people on board. And they've done this a number of times over the years. And this is the same company that's owned by Jeff Bezos. So it was going to go up at like around 9-ish, but they wound up going around 10:30 in the morning today. And you know, I remembered that they were going to be on, so I clicked on YouTube, and sure enough, there they were. A couple of the different stations had them. You know, space.com had them, and a couple of different ones. But it was successful. New Shepard, it's just one booster that goes up, and you've got the payload on top. In this case, six people in a capsule, and they run this 110,000 pound thrust engine, just one engine, liquid hydrogen, liquid oxygen, and they've done this a number of times. In fact, they call this NS-25. It stands for a New Shepard 25. Naturally, it's named after Alan Shepard, the first person to, first American to go into space, and he went on a suborbital flight, which took about 15, 16 minutes. And that's all this takes. It takes about the same amount of time. But they do get up to almost 3,000 miles per hour. The booster separates from the crew cabin. The booster comes down vertically and lands back in the desert. It comes down with no power whatsoever until it gets toward the end, around 3,000 feet off the ground. The engine starts to come back on, and instead of producing 110,000 pounds of thrust, it throttles down to around 20,000 pounds of thrust. And the booster lands successfully, and they could reuse it again, and I guess they'll use it for NS-26. Meanwhile, the capsule keeps going up, under the original force. Doesn't have any of its own thrusters. And it just gets to apogee, and during that time, the six people experience zero G for about 3-4 minutes, and then the capsule starts coming back down. And that, in turn, of course, gains speed as it's coming down. It starts to slow down until it starts to hit the atmosphere. They do have a heat shield. some degree that helped. And they don't get over, you know, 2,500 miles an hour on the way down. And then as they go a little lower, three parachutes are supposed to open up. And as it was coming down, I noticed one parachute did not open. So it is designed to safely land with two parachutes. And if it wasn't, we'd hear about that on the news with six souls on board. And they landed in the desert, and everybody got out okay. And it worked out okay. I'm sure there's going to be a good-sized investigation into what happened with that parachute. So, you know, and out of the six people that went up, there was one fella that went up, Ed Dwight, in his 90s, a little older than Shatner. William Shatner was, you know, had gone up a couple of flights ago. But Ed Dwight trained to be an astronaut back in the, you know, back in the early 60s. And he never went. Other people were chosen, and he never went. And he eventually, you know, did other things. They said he became a sculptor and all that. But he's still around. He's still in okay, you know, good shape. And somebody got the bright idea. Let's bring this guy into space, you know. And I saw him get out. He was a very happy guy. He said everybody should do this, and then along with five other people. So I don't know what's going to happen with this parachute. That reminds me of the Apollo 15 flight. You know, that's one of the ones that went to the moon. You know, you had 13 that went up. That was the one that didn't make it, but eventually made it safely back to Earth. Wound up making movies about that one. Then you had Apollo 14, and then 15. Well, 15 went up. Sure enough, what happens is the three parachutes did open up initially, but then one, for some reason, actually, you know, all the air went out of it. And when it came down, and by the time it landed in the water, it was under two parachutes. Again, also designed to fly with two parachutes. Any comments? WS2N.
Paul, this is Kilo Echo 2, Alpha Juliet Uniform. There's one spaceship going up in about 46 minutes. A Chinese one. What's on it?
That would be, I think that's the one with some communication equipment. That's not the big rocket. They have a lot of different rockets. They have the March 2, March 3, March 5 is the big one. That's the one that just went up recently. So I'll have to check on, I have a website with all the flights that go up. So I'm not sure which one that is. You know, they're sending up dozens of, well, I think last year they sent up like 60 or 70 rockets from China. So they're really moving along. Collectively, the world sent up 180 last year, and they're going to go over that this year, Charlie. So I'm not sure. We'll have to look into it. I think a week or two ago, you asked about a rocket. Has a rocket ever gone off in Australia? I believe that was you that asked about that. Sure enough, this month they do have a flight that's going off from Australia. This company, Gilmore Space, has built a three-stage orbital spacecraft. Rocket that's going to put up to three or four, I think max there's around 700 pounds of payload. So it's not a very big rocket. You know, it's a little over 80 feet long and around 5 feet in diameter. And I was going to bring that up tonight since you're on. I'm pretty sure you asked that question, Charlie, about the Australian rocket.
Yes, I did. It's scheduled for March 22nd at 3:15 in the morning.
Very good. More the merrier. I hope they make it. It's a different kind of fuel that they're using. They call it a hybrid rocket engine. Actually, similar to what the Virgin Galactic uses in their rocket. They have a hybrid rocket as well. You know, when they send crew up on suborbital flights spaceship, what do they call it? Spaceship 2, is the name they give it. I think it was called Unity. And they have that hybrid rocket too, so it's almost like a very fluid type of plastic. It's solid though, you know what I mean? But it's actually oxidized with nitric oxide. Nitric oxide is under a gas pressure, and this stuff is considered a solid. So, that's what they call it, a hybrid rocket. And if that one makes it from Australia, it'll be the first rocket to get into orbit with this new type of design. It's got some pluses and some negatives to it, but that's what they chose to go with. So it's a little something different. But if it works out, it'll be a relatively inexpensive rocket to put payloads into space. They'll be able to compete with, let's say, Rocket Lab, companies like that, with the Electron rocket. And anyway, it's called the Eris, and they're calling it the Eris Block 1 rocket. But I know you read about it. Back to you, Charlie.
Yeah, but is this rocket reusable?
No. They did not say that. You know, I don't know if they have that plan down, further down the line, but right now, no. Just a three-stage rocket, from what I understand. So it'll be it's a throwaway.
Now, China has two rockets this week. One that went today, and one that's going on Tuesday. Is this more satellite stuff?
I really don't know. They do send everything from spy satellites up to they actually have their own GPS system that they're developing as well. And further down the line, they plan on doing what Elon Musk does with Starlink. So, they have long-term goals of putting 30,000 satellites up into space, similar to what SpaceX wants to do. But they're not to that point yet. But when they are, they'll be launching every other day on a regular basis.
And we have another one coming up also on Tuesday at 4 a.m. in the morning. SpaceX, a Falcon 9.
Yeah, that'll be a Starlink mission. They send 22, sometimes 23 satellites up at a time. But I'm more interested in lately with the crews that are going up. For instance, the one I just talked about, suborbital launch, collectively over the last couple of years since they've been doing this, Blue Origin has sent now a total of 31 people into space. Again, six on this flight. They do six at a time now when they do it. They were shut down for almost 2 years because what happened, they had a flight, a successful flight about almost 2 years ago with a crew. And then they sent up another one identical to what they sent up, the New Shepard. But they had a problem with the booster, It was a mission just with science on board. You know, different companies pay to do this, to have experiments go up to suborbital flights. And that worked out okay. That made it back down to Earth with parachutes. But the booster didn't. That separated. And, they had problems with the nozzle of the booster. It unexpectedly got up to a much higher temperature than what it was normally supposed to be. So Blue Origin redesigned that system. A few other things they said they did, but you know that's why they've decided now to go back to sending crews up. They'll probably do this on a regular basis now. So it's light. Hopefully, going up this Saturday. They've been delayed many times, and that's the one from Boeing. Let me drop it. It's called the Starliner. The Starliner was supposed to launch a couple of weeks ago. They had some problems with an oxygen relief valve that was chattering, and they had to stop that. So they brought the whole rocket back into the facility, and moved it off the launch pad, and they were able to change out the oxygen relief valve. But then they came across another problem. They noticed there was a slight helium leak in the crew Starliner itself. The oxygen leak was in the upper stage, not in the crew vehicle, but in the crew vehicle they started to notice a light leak in the helium system. Helium is used to pressurize the rest of the system, the fuels that they use for the reaction control systems. And they have probably about 30 or 40 little rocket engines all over the Starliner. And that's under pressure with the using helium to do that. So they wanted to fix that one little leak, and they delayed it again. It was supposed to go off last week. Let me drop it. And now it's scheduled for a little after 3 o'clock, 3:09 on Saturday, this Saturday. So hopefully those two people get up okay. You have Wilmore and Sonny Williams going up. Sonny is ham radio operator, so she'll be going up. So just the two will be going to the International Space Station. I know I talked about this many, many times in the net because, they keep delaying it. It was supposed to go a couple of years ago. So finally, I'm going to guess that they're going to make it this Wednesday, hopefully. Once it gets certified, then in the future, NASA could use it for sending full crews up to the space station, full crew being four people at a time, similar to what SpaceX is doing. WS2N.
Yeah, this has got the Atlas V rocket. It's supposed to be good.
Oh, I concur. Very successful. They're all successful flights. This will be the 100th flight of the Atlas V. So hopefully that's a good luck number for them. We'll see. I just want to talk a minute about an agreement between NASA and the European Space Agency. They agreed to work collectively on the ExoMars rover called Rosalind Franklin. The Rosalind Franklin rover was supposed to go a couple of years ago. and that's being built by the European Space Agency. NASA really didn't have much to do with it. I think they had a little piece of equipment on board that they were going to get involved with, but they were pretty much hands off. They were working with the Russians. The Russians had built a descent section for the rover. So this way, when it would be coming down to Mars, that their descent module would fire its rockets and supposedly land safely on Mars. And it was also going to be launched by what they call the Proton rocket. That's their heavy lift vehicle in Russia. By the way, they're getting away from that one now. But that rocket was supposed to launch the rover for European Space Agency a few years ago. Time has ticked by. Russia, they invaded the Ukraine, and because of that, European Space Agency got away from them, and therefore it never launched. But this rover is completely built, ready to go. So now they're involved with NASA. NASA is going to pour a bunch of money into it, probably a couple $100 million, whatever it takes, to build their descent module, their descent platform with thrusters on there, controllable thrusters that could bring the vehicle safely down to Mars. And we'll see. They made an arrangement with them. They also told the European Space Agency, we'll let you have some uranium-238, which they could use for heating all the electronics and the components on the spacecraft. So, they're not going to have a radioisotope thermoelectric generator, from what I see, but they're going to use these radioactive pellets to keep electronics warm. And because they're radioactive, NASA won't let it out of their sight. They're going to wind up, we in this country are going to launch the rocket from our own soil. I don't know what rocket they're going to choose yet, but this won't happen for a couple of few years. I think launch date is now 2028, so it's a long way off, and landing on Mars will be 2030. But at least they'll finally get there. It is a solar panel vehicle, so it was never planned on having all these changes. But now NASA and the European Space Agency will work together on the Rosalind Franklin vehicle, named after, she was some kind of a chemist or something, really got involved with the beginnings of DNA, and she comes out of England, so European Space Agency named it after her, and we'll be looking forward to getting that vehicle eventually to Mars, to join the other two Mars rovers that are still riding around, Curiosity and Perseverance. The Chinese one stopped working, as far as I know. Any comments or questions?
No comments. I'm just listening right now. I'm trying to watch the Chinese launch, but I can't get it on my computer.
Yeah, maybe they're not streaming it. It might be a security launch, They don't even tell anybody that they're launching some of these things sometimes. But, yeah, okay. Yeah, that's our big competition now, China. but I'm not worried. I'm sure our government will fund a lot more missions. I just don't see them letting China get the upper hand, that's for sure. They got a long way to catch us. We've had 12 people put on the moon already. That was half a century ago. So I think they got a long way to go. I want to bring up the machine company, IM. You know, that's the one that a few months back, they landed a vehicle on the moon called the Nova C, and it landed and then tilted over. You know, I think it hit a rock on its way down, and it had some lateral movement, you know, sort of like tripping, you know, and the front end tilted over 30 degrees, you know, on an angle, not 90. And it still worked to some degree. You know, they got a lot of information back. NASA had a half a dozen experiments on board. They worked. Took them a little longer to get it back because they didn't have the bandwidth that they needed because the antenna was not pointing right. They had to use the omnidirectional antenna and a great big dish antenna down in Australia to pick up all the data. But eventually it worked. Well, now they're going to be sending another one toward the end of the year. Intuitive Machines will be launching another Nova C rocket to the moon, and we'll see how this one does. This, you know, they've made some major changes, and a couple of simple changes. One of the changes that they needed to do was fix the rangefinder laser system. Nova C has a laser setup where it can tell, you know, looks at the land on the moon, it knows how fast it's moving, knows, you know, where it is in space, you know, as it's coming down very close to the land. And that system failed, and the only reason it failed is they deactivated it for a couple of tests on Earth before they launched it. And one of the steps that they were supposed to do before they put the rocket onto the launch pad was to reactivate this laser finding thing. It works on an infrared laser detecting system. And they never turned it back on. So they, when it got to the moon, they had a problem. The only reason it did get as far as it did and land somewhat safe is because NASA had a similar system on board that they were testing, and they were able to talk about a software update. They did a quick software-defined radio system and fixed that problem and switched the system that was not working to NASA's infrared laser system. And sure enough, that did work. It worked out okay. Now, this time, problem. So we'll hope Nova C makes it to the moon. Any comments?
Yeah, what kind of drone are they going to send to the moon?
Yeah, I don't call it a drone, but it's a spacecraft, unmanned spacecraft. And that's similar to the last one that they launched, and by the way, it was launched by SpaceX. They were the launch provider for it. And Nova C is a pretty tall spacecraft, around 8 feet high to the top. It's got six legs to it, and it's designed to send tons of information back to NASA and, you know, mission control. So, I don't know. I wouldn't call it a drone. I'd call it a regular spacecraft, I guess. It's got solar panels on board to power it up. The last one wasn't designed to make it through a lunar night, which is 14 days. I haven't heard about this one. I don't know if this one is scheduled to be able to go through the lunar night or not. I don't think so, but we'll see. Back to you.
Okay, as long as they're sending up a drone. You know, this way you can search around and look, see what's beyond the horizon in somebody's holes, get a lot of information like that.
Well, no, this is a lander. Once it lands, that's, it's not going anywhere. I don't think it has any little rovers coming out of it. Peregrine had that. That's the one that didn't make it to the moon. That had two little landers that were going to roll around on the moon. So, yeah. And for now, they have to have, you know, powerful radio communications. They transmit all the way back to Earth. We don't have any, you know, a large group of communication satellites orbiting the moon. You know, at Mars you do. You know, if you have a lander on Mars, there's a, quite a few satellites going around Mars that they use as repeaters for the whatever landers that we have down there. You really don't have that on the moon yet. But some way, someday down, you know, not too far in the future, they'll have satellites that can talk to who's ever on the moon, either manned or unmanned, and you'll be able to relay that back to Earth from the satellites.
And that would be a good idea to put a satellite around the moon, would be.
Yeah, yeah, you just need a couple of them, a few of them, to do that, more than a couple. So you can do that on a regular basis. You know, we have, there's a couple of satellites that we use. We have the Lunar Reconnaissance Orbiter, and that's up there taking pictures on a regular basis since 2009. Then you have a Korean spacecraft going around in orbit that NASA was involved with to some degree. They utilize that. You know, so you got a couple. That's about it. China had one, but that stopped working. Once we have the Gateway station in place, that'll be good because that'll be roughly 11-day orbit. So it'll go all, you know, from maybe a couple thousand miles above the surface of the moon all the way out to 40,000 miles away. So, but, you know, to make that orbit, highly elliptical orbit, it's going to take roughly about 11 days. So out of most of those 11 days, you'll be able to communicate with, let's say, the South Pole on a regular basis. So that'll be good. That's a long way away, you know, and we have equipment that's being built for that. This module is being built right now. It will be part of that space station. And these will, you know, that will be a manned space station, a crewed space station. They could spend, you know, a month or two in orbit. That won't be 100% manned, you know, 365 days a year. That'll probably be, you know, in the beginning, probably a month here and a month there with crews. But eventually they'll have that, you know. But for now, it's a direct contact back to the Deep Space Network from the moon.
Now, I don't have anything to add right now on that.
Okay, Charlie. Also coming up, and this was supposed to be, well, this was supposed to have happened already, but now it's June, and I'm starting to think more like September or October, is the Dream Chaser. That's the one that Sierra Nevada, well, now they changed their name, Sierra Space has built, and they named it Tenacity. Tenacity will be a spacecraft that will sit on top of a Vulcan rocket. A Vulcan rocket is the new rocket that ULA has built. It's launched once very successfully so far, and this will be supposedly the second launch of the Vulcan rocket. And they'll be sending that to the International Space Station. Now, that'll be sitting on top of something they call Shooting Star. Shooting Star is, I mean, weight-wise and size-wise, it's about the same size as the Dream Chaser, same size of Tenacity. The Dream Chaser is designed to be berthed, connected to the International Space Station, and they'll be able to take thousands of pounds of cargo out of that one. You're looking at 12,000 to 14,000 pounds of stuff. So it'll be really useful for the seven people on board the space station. You can get, food, clothes, experiments, tons of stuff, literally, out of the Dream Chaser. After it's done, that part is reusable. That part will actually fly back to Earth and land on a runway, just like the old shuttle. It's about 25% the size of a shuttle, but, it'll still be able to do that. The part that's attached to it, called a shooting star, primarily a cargo vehicle, and also has solar panels that come out of it. So when it's in orbit, before and after it leaves the International Space Station, it'll be powered up by those solar panels from Shooting Star. So let's say you have in the International Space Station a lot of valuable stuff that has to come back to Earth, for the scientists, refrigerated equipment, whatever it might be, that would all go into Tenacity. And then let's say you have a bunch of junk and things you want to dispose of that they do on a regular basis with other vehicles like Cygnus. They'll put all that stuff into Shooting Star, and as this whole thing starts to deorbit, getting Tenacity ready to, go through the atmosphere, it will separate the Shooting Star. Shooting Star will burn up and burn up all the stuff that they needed to get rid of, leaving Tenacity to come through the atmosphere and land like a little shuttle. It's got wings and everything. Someday in the future, Sierra Space is already getting ready to eventually have a crewed vehicle, a crewed version of the Dream Chaser. That's always been their plan. Any comments?
No comments.
Okay, another flight coming up would be the, Vulcan with this particular vehicle. If time, sometimes these vehicles, like the Dream Chaser, are not going to be ready or in time, Vulcan still needs to have another launch. They've already had a successful launch. They launched the Peregrine, landed to the moon. Peregrine didn't work out, but it had nothing to do with the launch vehicle. It was first flight, and everything worked 100% with the brand new engines by Blue Origin, called the E4 engines. And these were liquid methane, liquid oxygen engines, very powerful, don't forget the Vulcan is designed to actually replace the Atlas V rocket. So the deal is NASA needs, well, not NASA, but any government agency, NASA or National Reconnaissance Office or Defense or any government agency that wants to fly Vulcan. Vulcan has to have two successful flights that have nothing to do with, high security payload. So they don't have any other payload that nobody else wants to go on it right now. They might just launch what they call a mass simulator. They might just do a launch and send it up with this big heavy weight, and then they'll be able to tell the United States government, look, that's our second flight. You need that two flights to have it certified to launch future government flights. They just might do that. We'll see. Any comments?
Yeah, I was looking up for the for the satellite to go to the moon. They have nothing there on the computer, no dates, not nothing.
Yeah, that's because it's at the tail end of the year. You know, I wouldn't be surprised if it's November or maybe even December. And that would be Intuitive Machines. Nova C, you could probably put that, you know, Nova C into, probably even Wikipedia has it, and you look, Next Flight, you know, for Nova C, I think they're going to call it, they're going to call it Mission IM-2, India Mike 2, Nova C launch, and they'll probably, you'll find something that might say launch of the new Nova C vehicle toward the end of the year. Something like that. Charlie, back to you.
I figured with all the satellites going up into space, of them, one can't go to the moon. You got one on Mars.
Yeah, no, they have plenty of missions planned for the moon, Charlie. Plenty of them. Quite a few companies that are involved with this. Not only for us, Japan. We already know about China. But we'll see. And ultimate goal is to send people. That's a couple of years away now. The next scheduled manned flight to the moon, but not landing on the moon, would be September of next year. And I'm questioning that right now. NASA's trying to figure out what happened to their last flight. The heat shield kind of got burnt up quite a bit, much more than they expected. So they're looking into that. I guess if they can solve that problem anytime soon, we'll have a flight in September of next year. I'm not going to hold my breath on that. I think they got some serious problems with the heat shield. Big 16-foot diameter heat shield. I mean, it's large. And we'll see.
That time complete.
Yeah, we'll follow it as time goes on. We're getting up to 11 o'clock anyway. Unless anybody has any more comments, questions, I think we'll pass it back to Dr. Roy.
Yeah, I was offline for a little while, WB2BX, so here, Paul. Did you cover Starship?
I've been reading about them. They keep talking about possibility of the fourth flight going up. But, they keep pushing it back week after week. And I keep listening to, Musk keeps tweeting out that, another week, and I don't go by that. I need to hear from Shotwell, the woman. She runs that whole Starship setup. She's a little bit more accurate. Have you heard, Frank, that it's going up? I mean, number four would be, last I heard, at least three weeks away. You know, they were looking at maybe middle of June.
That's apparently what Musk tweeted a couple of days ago, that it was 3 to 5 weeks away. It looks to me like some of the videos that it might actually be this week, but he's usually overly optimistic. So if he says 3 to 5 weeks, assuming he said that last week, that's a couple of weeks away yet. My impression is it's going to be a repeat of Flight 3. They're reinforcing the heat shield, and they want to try to demonstrate that they can actually bring the Starship back and make it reusable before they actually go for a full orbit with the thing. Go ahead.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah, they have to. They'll have to do that. They don't want to put a gigantic Starship into Earth orbit and find out they can't get it back. They've got to know that this thing's coming back and coming back where they want it to come back. The last thing you need is another Skylab up there, you know. Gee, I wonder where it's going to land. That's so we don't want that. Back to you, Brian.
Yeah, I guess so. they probably been told legally they can't put it in orbit until they can get it back, since it's too large to completely burn up in the atmosphere. And not really sure what's going on there, but that may be the answer. Go ahead, Paul.
Yeah, and the last I've read, quite a few times anyway, over the last, I guess, month, they still don't have their license from the government to launch. Although I do know they do react quickly. Last time they had the license, it was like a couple of days after that, they launched number three.
I know one version I saw was that they want to launch right away once they have the license, because they want to launch before any of the environmental groups can get a restraining order that they can't do it because they might harm some insect or other.
Yeah, I know. I think the last time, what was it? I think it was the turtles or something last time. You know. Yeah. Well, he's rolling a dice down there, that's for sure. I'm surprised the land is even stable enough to do this. You know, it looks like he's down in swamp country. But I guess they're okay. They've done three of them already, so I guess, you know, I guess they'll continue to do that. They're also building another launch tower, so this way they can launch and then, you know, on one, and come back and try to catch the other one out of the sky with the other one. I guess they want two launch towers. You know, if they screw up, they won't have any other way to launch a future starship. What are you going to do? Right, I'm looking at the time. I'm going to turn this back over to Roy. We'll be on tomorrow night for Limark InfoNet. And, of course, Swap and Shop is after that. That's always followed by Newsline. So, Frank, 73, we'll try to stick around another minute or two after Roy closes, the repeater will go back to normal operation at that time. Roy, AC2GS, WS2N, back to you.
Very good. AC2GS, our rebels now are done. Thank you, Paul. Thank you for the SpaceNet report. Thank you for all that you do for the technical net, all that you do for the club. We all appreciate it. I especially do. I just wanted to point out, you mentioned in passing Rosalind Franklin, gifted X-ray crystallographer. That was a very dangerous science specialty back in the 50s when she worked. She was the one who crystallized the DNA and did the X-ray crystallography that demonstrated the double helix structure, which her boss gave a copy to Watson and Crick. Watson and Crick got the Nobel Prize, And Rosalind Franklin, unfortunately, got cancer from being exposed to too many X-rays.